Good evening, and welcome to What a World! Celebrating diversity and loving it, this is Nevin Campanella bringing you a radio talk show that has no limits and bows to no one. From this microphone, we bring you guests who will lead you across those shadowy plains of forbidden knowledge. And in a few minutes, that forbidden knowledge will be revealed to us by John Kamansky, author of The Perfect Enemy. We would have had a report tonight from Charlotte King. Unfortunately, we have to wait till next week. Not due to Charlotte's problem, but our equipment problem. Soon to be rectified. Now, for the next bit of news, a little bit on history. What occurred on this date in history? Well, in 1950, the comic strip Peanuts by Charles Schulz was first published in 7 U.S. newspapers. Also in 1955, Alfred Hitchcock debuts, and in 1959, Twilight Zone pilot premieres. Everybody remembers that. I'm still watching those shows. Also in 1962, Johnny Carson debuts as host of The Tonight Show. So what's going on in the world news? Well, there's one very interesting piece of news that seems to get sidetracked. Essentially, it comes down to this. The European nation wants to maintain some type of control over the Internet. And, quote, a senior U.S. official reiterated Thursday that the country, meaning the United States, wants to remain the Internet's ultimate authority, rejecting calls in a United Nations meeting in Geneva for a U.N. body to take over. Folks, can you imagine the Internet being run by the U.N.? That's good for a belly laugh. And now for tonight's show. We have John Kamansky, who lives on the Gulf Coast of Florida, well-known commentator on world events, politics, and especially the havoc created by our fearless leaders in Washington, D.C. John's insights were described by Gary Coles, a practicing physician in Duluth, Minnesota, and an associate of every church, of every church, a peace church, quote, not just for these times, but for those future generations who might smell a rat somewhere and need some help to figure out where the stench is coming from. Well, folks, I think we know where the stench is coming from, which kind of reminds me of something else that occurred in the news. If you've been following the blogging news, you'll note a number of posts that have been made by Nancy Leader about a strange smell emanating from the streets of different cities. So there is a stench, actually and literally, coming out of the streets. Back to John. Two of John's primary issues are, one, what he calls the hoax of 9-1-1, and two, the Jewish Zionist control of the media. And in an article reviewing the sudden cancellation of his appearance on Power Hour, John gives us a clue as to where the stench is coming from when he states, quote, because the United States is run by a criminal syndicate that has merged the financial influence of the petroleum and pharmaceutical industries with the lawless behavior of the government, America is now a criminal nation, and all Americans, hiding in their self-centered, consumerist ignorance, are accessories to an awesome array of crimes against humanity. That's quite a statement.
God, it is an awesome array, isn't it?
It is an awesome array,
and it happens every day.
John, you've got a lot to say about world events and political leaders, but before we get to that, tell us, how did you actually get started as a commentator?
I did my first newspaper when I was 9 years old in pencil. The lead headline was H-bomb tests in Pacific. I had my first newspaper byline in the seventh grade. I started out as a sports writer and began writing essays very much like this that were sports related. Then I became a newspaper editor of a bunch of papers in New Hampshire, Vermont, and other places. And, God, after almost 30 years in that business, I was working for a newspaper on the Gulf Coast of Florida for about 5 years, but I didn't write for them. I just processed pages because I really didn't have confidence in the newspaper, and I was just working there to pay the bills. And then 9/11 happened, and I saw it on television, and I, about 15 minutes after it happened, I said, no way, this is not what happened.
Okay, John, before we get directly to that, I'd like you to give everyone some information on two of your books and how they can acquire them. One of them is The Perfect Enemy, and the other is The Day America Died. How could people get in touch with you, or how can they acquire this material?
The simplest way is www.johnkaminsky.com. My mailing address is on that website. Many of my essays are on that website, and explanations about all three books. The America's Autopsy Report and The Perfect Enemy are collections of my best internet essays, and The Day America Died is a 48-page chapbook that is subtitled Why You Shouldn't Believe the Official Story of What the Government Said About September 11, 2001.
Okay, well, you actually do call it a hoax. So let's start at the beginning. What kind of evidence do you use to arrive at this conclusion? And I mean, admittedly, it's a conclusion that is very different than what you would find in national media. So give us how you see it, how you view it, and how you put the information together.
After reading, you know, thousands of stories, I think the salient feature is the way the Twin Towers fell. The impact of the airplanes didn't seriously affect the structural integrity of the towers. It didn't penetrate the 47, it didn't destroy the 47 core columns in the middle of the building, which supported the building. The fires were not burning very intensely when the towers fell. There was no correlation between the fires and the towers. Now, the government, in its clumsy attempt to stifle all investigations into the forensics of these matters, the cover-up of the disappearance of the rubble is really a criminal matter unto itself, but no one seems to have asked very obvious questions. And a key component of everything that's going on in America now is, why isn't the public adhering to basic standards of logic? When someone works to cover up an investigation, they're obviously involved in the crime. But getting back to the towers, there's so much testimony now from security guards and witnesses about and firemen who are starting to... The cover-up of keeping the firemen quiet has started to leak now, and there have been various stories about firemen reporting a multitude of explosions in the towers before they actually fell, but after the planes hit. And William Rodriguez and two other security guards have toured the country extensively and spoken of these matters. William Rodriguez is a forgotten and suppressed American hero who actually, because he had the keys, he was really a janitor in the World Trade Center, but he had the keys to a lot of doors, which he opened and saved a lot of people. He was the last man out of the towers. And his testimony has been completely ignored. He testified before the Kane Commission, which was a whitewash of the whole ordeal. The first meeting of the Kane Commission was Thomas Kane announcing that Osama bin Laden was guilty and we were going to investigate the rest of it. Well, that's absurd on its face. And so was the Kane report. But anyway, back to the towers. The key feature of the falling of the towers, and why anybody who's looked into these matters sees it obviously as a controlled demolition, is the speed at which they fell. The planes impacting the buildings high up would not break the core columns down low, and that had to happen in order for the buildings to fall as fast as they did. How fast?
Yeah, I watched it on television as it was they were taking down, and it was extremely rapid. No question about that. So I have to agree with you. I can't imagine how the plane that hit the top of that tower could collapse that entire building so quickly.
It couldn't have broken the core columns at its bases. That had to be done by explosives, and there is quite a bit of very compelling testimony from a variety of sources about reports of explosions in the basement by people who heard them. But the photographic evidence, and photographic evidence in these matters has been maybe misused by some people who make certain fantastic claims about the tragedy. But basically, the photographic evidence reveals little puffs of white smoke coming as the buildings collapsed. They were preceded down the side of the building by little puffs of white smoke, which if you've seen them on video, you draw the obvious conclusions that there's some kind of explosives. But the time that the towers took to, after they started collapsing, to reach their final destination on the ground was roughly 10 seconds. And the thing that struck many people as odd on the videos was that the debris that was falling that had been ejected out to the side, maybe by explosives, maybe by the force of the concussion and compression of the building, the stuff that was falling off to the side was falling at the same rate of the buildings, which means the building was falling at free fall speed. And the only way for that to happen was if all of the 47 core columns in each of the towers was severed at their bases. So that
all at the same time.
It's all at the same time. So that building could fall smoothly, and it fell so smoothly, and those puffs of white smoke. I mean, it's a controlled demolition. It's obviously a controlled demolition.
It looked like a demolition type of project.
Sure.
Something else that occurred so suddenly was that within, what, a day, 2 days at the most, they had the names of all the people they claimed were the terrorists. It was so amazingly fast, it was as if they had the names on a list waiting to put it out.
Funny you should mention that. I like to put that fact together like this, and you pretty much put it together, but there's a certain irony in it, in that the very people, Rice, Rumsfeld, Myers, and Cheney, all said on the day of the terrible events, we had no idea something like this could happen. They all said that for public consumption to some media spokesperson. And less than 24 hours later, people who didn't know that something like this could happen had a list of the names of the people who did it. Now, that's a magic trick of the first magnitude.
Yeah, they pulled that out of their hat.
Well, it obviously proves the lies they were saying the previous day. And then it turns out we learn quite some time later that the government was conducting a series of drills on that very day regarding various aspects of NORAD security. And it turned out, as Mike Rupert has reported, it turned out that Dick Cheney was in charge, so that he had control, effective operational control of America's air defenses for this pivotal moment in American history. Kind of a planned incompetence that prevented the proper interception of these apparent weapons. They started out as airliners, but in the final box score, they turned out to be weapons.
Well, let's get back to Mr. Rodriguez for a second here, John.
Sure.
He's apparently now he is making statements.
There is a lot more publicity about him, and that's all good, because the more people are talking about this, the better I like it.
Well, how does he manage to escape, you know, from the quote, gun sites of Washington, D.C.? I mean, I would think
he's still very marginalized at this point, as am I. And it's like NBC has 3.5 hours of interview footage with William Rodriguez in which he told this whole story. And obviously they have no plans on running any of that because it doesn't fit in with the corporate mission that shapes the news that all Americans get.
Okay, hold on. I don't want to get into the next part yet. I know where you're going with that one. In terms of things about 911, Michael Moore created a documentary. I think it was called Fahrenheit 911.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout that documentary, he gave kind of a chilling report of the financial transactions that were going on within Saudi Arabia and within our political families within the United States. What is your reaction to Michael Moore's documentary?
Well, my favorite part of it, I think the best part of it, was when he had the photograph, the footage of George Bush sitting in that chair at the school, squirming, after Andrew Card had told him that the second plane had hit the tower. And he did that for, I don't know how many, whether it was 8 minutes or 20 minutes. But it certainly was an embarrassing moment. And one interesting article by a fellow named Jared Israel a long time ago insisted that his behavior showed consciousness of guilt. I don't know how much of a subjective analysis that is, but there was certainly something odd about his behavior. This is our commander-in-chief who's supposed to be responding to an attack on the country.
And yeah, there's no question.
And
it was odd.
And he sits in a second-grade class for 20 minutes. I mean, something's definitely wrong with that picture.
How would you interpret that? I mean, I watched the film, John, and this man just kept staring blankly as if he was somewhere in outer space.
That was his attempt to convince the public that he didn't know what was going on, which is something he's very good at.
But he also did not respond either. I mean, besides sitting there, he didn't say to the individual, call out the guards, call this, do that. I mean, he just kind of ignored it at that point because it took a second statement from the individual to get his attention.
Yeah, it's a very good barometer of how far American intelligence has fallen off. I was listening to Walter Cronkite on Larry King last night, and he said that this nation has never been so ignorant as it is now of just basic things. It's like I keep saying to friends, I think back to when the 50s or the 60s, when we still had an actual society and some of the political debates actually sounded real. And people's concerns, at least the government made a pretense of addressing. Now there's none of that. And it's all bottom-line, jackbooted mentality now. This is, we're a nation that just practices and condones torture.
We a nation of ignorant people, or are we a nation of people in denial? I think this is a pretty important question that I'd like you to address.
I don't think so. I think there's something physiologically different. There's something wrong, and it's manifested by this. I mean, society has always been schizophrenic, and there has always been the news behind the news, where stories are released for public consumption. But when you start thinking about who runs the world, the story is completely different. Now we're seeing where it's become becoming pretty clear with the abandonment of all those people in New Orleans that it's becoming pretty clear that the government has absolutely no pretense of even protecting our interests.
No, none at all. I mean, that was a total sham.
Yeah, and it's just going to do what the people who control the money want to do. So I think the American people are feeling really abandoned right now, and this makes it actually a good time to talk about 911. Because I can't overstress the importance of understanding what happened on 911. Because in order to not understand it, you have to remain in that coma that allows the powers that be to continue on this homicidal and suicidal course that America is now on.
You know, John, back in 1999, Universal Studios came out with a movie, A Long Kiss Goodnight. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
No.
Well, the movie gives a logical answer as to why such atrocities as 911 might be planned by our own government. I mean, basically, it came down to black op organizations within the government who want more money actually go out and create a, quote, a terrorist-appearing kind of cataclysm, okay?
Yeah, that's what they've done. They've done it over and over.
Well, I after watching that movie, and I watched it a few times after the 911 experience, and I, you know, John, it's as if someone wrote a script, put it out there for the public to see, and said to them, "Hold on, folks, because this is what's going to happen." I would advise everyone to, if you get a chance, to take a look at that movie, because there's such a similarity between what happened in that movie and what actually happened to us. John, there's a couple of things that you have mentioned in your articles on deciphering the 911 distraction, and it comes down to what happens to individuals such as Mr. Rodriguez, who actually attempt to look beyond this, quote, smokescreen set in place by our government. That quote is from you, by the way. So I'll ask you the question you originally proposed. What happens when these finally brave individuals go looking for alternative information about the unspeakable tragedy and cynical deception that followed? What happens to them, John?
Well, I think thus far, anybody who's attempted to do that has met a welcoming network of people who are working on the same problem and then have chosen the version of it that they've liked and pursued their ideas with some support. There is a more well-known group of people who have spoken out publicly, and to date the major voices are David Ray Griffin, who's written two books, one about 911 and one about the Keene Commission cover-up, and a fellow named Morgan Reynolds, who's an emeritus professor at Texas A&M, who basically surveyed all the information out there, and him being a former Bush financial guy in the administration of Poppy Bush, he had some cachet of political credence in certain circles. So his remarks had some more widespread public consumption, but there's such a news blackout on all of this throughout the country. There's nothing on commercial radio. There's nothing on commercial television. The few instances of the emergence of the 911 issue on commercial television have all been of the type that was on CNN with that... I believe his name is Cooper, and he had Jimmy Walter on. But in bringing Jimmy Walter on, he had a couple of designated governmental hitmen right there to ridicule what Jimmy Walter was saying. And Jimmy Walter has made a valiant effort to publicize this issue, but he's perhaps not the best spokesperson. The 911 skeptics movement has really suffered by, as have most 911 researchers, have really suffered from a lack of financial support, because the implications of proving the 911 skeptic's assertion that 911 was an inside job, I think one of the implications of that would be the collapse, the complete collapse of the American economy, because if you couldn't trust the government on that scale, and God knows we certainly can't, but we pretend to continue to do so. But if it became known that Bush pulled off 911, I think the all the financial establishments in probably the Western world, which are already in deep trouble because of derivative scams and things like that.
Well, our financial situation worldwide is at the absurd level.
And they may yet do that. Well, I mean, a lot of people have been talking about that for a long time, that the system is going to be deliberately collapsed and recalibrated, favored even more toward the rich.
You know, John, even in a good murder mystery, one of the things that always comes up is, was there a motive? That's what people look for. You know, the detective searches about. What is the motive here? Let's assume for an instance that you're correct in your assertion 911 was an inside job. The problem I have, even though I understand the evidence you present, is I can't come up with a motive.
There are two classical footnotes. One is from Zbigniew Brzezinski's Grand Chessboard, a 1997 book that talks about control of Central Asia being the key to the upcoming geopolitical struggle over the next couple of decades. And his famous line, I think it's on page 47, is in order to be more aggressive abroad, we have to be less democratic at home. And then he goes on to describe the need for some major threat to America being used to mobilize a more focused military capability. And then, of course, the other classical citation is from the infamous PNAC report, Project for a New American Century, written in the 2000 and signed by all the Republican luminaries like Dick Cheney and Jeb Bush and all those fellows, that stressed the need to accomplish their plan of rebuilding America's defenses and becoming a much more controlling factor throughout the world, is the statement that in order to implement these plans, some kind of new Pearl Harbor type event to focus everyone's attention on some very helpful to their cause, and bam, a year later, 9/11.
Are you expecting, John, another incident?
I don't know. I don't really think in those terms. I don't really go for prophecies or future fears. Everybody's talking about bird flu and chemtrails and aspartame and so many things that people can obsess about. I find that probably the one thing that's missing is putting all these mind-bending news headlines into some kind of context, because it seems like crisis after crisis, they slip by us into the memory hole. And occasionally some things are big, like the invasion of Iraq. That was a big thing, and that has kind of slipped past us. We try not to think about it. But the death toll is getting pretty high.
Yeah, it's getting phenomenal. You know, John, most Americans don't have a clue as to why our government does what it does.
Yeah.
Most people, they just assume that our government does everything to protect the interests of Americans.
And that's
how
why
would you answer that? Is that assumption wrong?
Well, the minute you stop paying attention to aspects of your own wealth, can't expect those aspects to remain in your favor. And it's the same with representative democracy. If you agree to send someone somewhere to look after your interests and don't pay attention to what he's doing, then he's very soon going to stop looking after your interests, looking after his own. And if there was ever a case of that, all you have to do is look at the halls of Congress.
Yeah, it's been gone. It's gone on for so many years, and we were given fair warning of that by Thomas Jefferson.
It's the nature of the system. And it's just now. This is another point I'd like to make. It's just now with people who want to talk about impeaching Bush. Bush is not the problem. The problem is the system. And it doesn't really matter who's president. The same people are always in charge. And that's been proven when Bill Clinton was in office, there were all these ties to Israel. And, you know, when George Bush is in office, basically we've had the same crowd ever since Nixon got kicked out. Well, Carter was in there for a while, but they sabotaged Carter and they got Reagan back in. And ever since then, we've had the same bunch of capitalist pigs out to destroy the world in charge. And most Americans, the most frightened.
Given what you just said,
don't
John,
seem to mind that.
If what you're saying is true, that it's the lack of participation, it's the apathy of the American public that is actually creating the problem, or at least pushing it along, then no amount of change in government is going to do anything. Does this kind of, in your mind, negate the argument of the, quote, Illuminati, those individuals who are somehow amorphous and out there and trying to control us all? What is your feeling about that?
I think there is a de facto group that has the participation of every country in the world, and it's not the UN. It's a banking group. Every faction in the world knows what every other faction is doing, basically, and that they're all in contact. Be they European royalty, the Yakuza in Japan, or the Chinese triad gangs, those are all in contact. And that there is a kind of world congress of financiers that's of an informal nature. And that there are really no enemy states until this group decides that they have a reason for public consumption and enough financial incentive to go in there and take over that country and take what they want. And I think that's how it works.
Well, given what you just said, then what they do is they use the existing apathy for their own gain. But that would also mean that at some level, even if we all became, I don't know, radicals, as we did back in the 60s, it still wouldn't help because these people would still find a way to keep us in our place. Isn't that correct?
Sure, it's bread and circuses, or it's internet pornography and sports. It's something.
I've heard a lot of people just call it power. Listen,
the leadership doesn't want the people involved in the political system, so they create all these bread and circuses, all these games to keep us out of their business.
It's a large stage of distraction, I guess. What does George W. Bush hope to gain in Iraq? If it was oil, you sure can't tell it by what's happening at the gas pumps.
I missed that question. I missed that question. You faded on me, or I faded on you.
Well, why does George Bush go into Iraq? I mean, what's the point? If there was oil to be had, we should be seeing lower gas prices, not higher. So why is he there to begin with? What did he hope to gain?
Well, the new money-making scheme seems to be reconstruction projects. When a place is destroyed, then you have to rebuild it. And there's all this money to be made on the reconstruction contracts. I was just writing something about that tonight.
That's an old gimmick.
Yeah, when Halliburton gets a contract, what they do is immediately take half of it off the top, subcontract the job for half the price to somebody who probably isn't competent. The subcontractor takes the job at half the price and may even pass it on to somebody else, taking half off the top. And the person who winds up doing the job is not really qualified, but because that wasn't the purpose of the legislation to begin with. The purpose of the legislation was to be able to take half of it off the top, and they don't really care that the job gets done. So all of this, all of these billions of dollars that have been spent in contracts have really resulted in no tangible work in Iraq, and have really resulted only in all this graft being taken off the top and being fed to the corporate friends of Bush and all the other elite power brokers.
Well, right now, GWB has got a lot of pressure on him to get out of Iraq, even from his own political party. So who is ever gaining on this, they must be doing something to help him out of the situation, or they can never feather their own nest again anywhere else.
Well, I can't imagine.
I
don't think that's something they need to be too worried about with the money they have now. I guess not.
Family,
are you kidding me? Sherman Skolnick says that Poppy Bush has an $11 billion joint account with the Queen of England.
Oh.
You know, I don't know anything about that, but that's what he says. They have so much money. I mean, they're like the Rothschilds. I'll never forget when I first started investigating the Rothschilds, and I began calculating their wealth as best I could from the numerous sources, because they stay pretty secret about what they do. Their total wealth was like much greater, much, 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 much greater than the entire gross national product of the United States. I mean, we were talking serious money. So that $78 billion for Iraq is almost like petty cash for them.
Well, you bring us to a point which is something you keep talking about quite a bit. You bring up the Rothschild, so I might as well jump to the question of, quote, Jewish Zionist control of the media. Now, before we get into that, I got to tell you up front, John, it's hard to read your articles because it seems as if an awful lot of the articles you write always go back to a finger pointing at Israel itself.
And you know why that is?
Well, I'm going to ask you a question. Are you anti-Semitic?
Because Israel controls the United States.
Have you been accused, John, of being anti-Semitic?
Oh God, all the time.
Well, okay, so answer the question. Let's get it on the air.
What
I'm asking you the question directly. Are you or are you not?
What is an anti-Semite?
You answer it for me. All I could say is someone who, if you look it up in a dictionary, it would say you hate Jews. That would be the definition
That would be an incorrect definition, because Semites are the populations of that Arab region over there. And Semites also include Arabs and Palestinians and Iraqis and all these other people, of which the Sephardic Jews are part. The original descendants of the original Jewish culture from the time of Christ, they're called Sephardic Jews. And the Ashkenazi Jews are the Jews from Central Asia who really had nothing to do with Israel except to be part of an empire in 800 AD that adopted Judaism in a choice for their culture between a choice among Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. They chose to be Judaics. And they form the Yiddish culture of Eastern Europe, which we know when we see Jewish people today, most of them are descended from that area. They really had nothing to do with Israel except to adopt its creed. Until the nation of Israel was created by the Zionists in the 20th century, and this was a gradual process that took about 75 years to accomplish, and they finally got their country in 1948, and there's been fighting there ever since.
Okay, there's an old argument. Maybe you can address this tonight. When the Jewish state was literally created in 1948, post-World War II, according to lore, now I don't know how true it is, according to lore, The Palestinians were also given the same opportunity to devise a state. Do you believe that to be true?
I don't think there was ever an equal opportunity for the Palestinians about anything, because when the Israelis arrived, they immediately started destroying Palestinian cities. In fact, some Israelis seem to be proud to point out the fact that all of the Palestinian cities that existed prior to the Jewish arrival were actually destroyed by Israelis and renamed with Israelis' names, so that thousands of Palestinian towns have been erased.
Well, that is true.
Yeah, of course, that is true.
Anybody can find that out. That information is quite public.
And
okay, back to
the whole story that's been told now for half a century and longer is that we've got Palestinian terrorists against Israeli freedom fighters, and exactly the opposite is true. It's the Israelis who went in there, terrorized everything, bribed Western politicians to give them every advantage, gets billions, trillions of dollars a year from the United States. Israel is the number one recipient of American foreign aid. I think it's every American pays $5,000 every year for this Israel. That's the average.
The Zionist control of the media, John, how do they control it?
Oh, well, all you got to do is check out the ownership lists. That's not rocket science. You look at the CEOs of every major network, with the exception of Fox, which is Rupert Murdoch, who only had a Jewish mother, so he's not considered a complete Jew. The owners are all Jewish of every major newspaper in America. Think about it. Haven't you read Ben Bagbekian, Media Monopoly?
Yeah, it's no secret that there's a Jewish name connected, but you're pointing at more than just a Jewish name. You seem to be suggesting a conspiracy of sorts.
Oh, definitely. Absolutely.
Okay.
We're talking about the Anti-Defamation League. We're talking about Edgar Bronfman. We're talking about the richest Jews in control more than we know, definitely.
Well, what would it be their primary goal? I mean, here we have what you call the Jewish Zionist control of the media. What's the point?
Well, the point is that you can't have anybody talk about anybody who disagrees with Israel or Jewish interests. You ever hear of the Palestinians who are being exterminated as we speak?
Ah, okay. You're making sense, John. The conspiracy then goes again back to protecting Israel.
You can't get elected to any public office in this country if you utter the word Palestine. And if you're in Congress and happen to say that, the chances are excellent that you'll be out of Congress in short order, which has happened like 7 times since the mid-80s, the most recent things.
We're going to run out of time here. I've got about 8 million questions I want to ask you. So I'm going to have to jump pretty quick. I want to get to, look, John, it's no secret that you're a hard-hitting commentator, often being said as extremely radical. However, I found a side to John that I never knew existed. You wrote an article called Cyberspace Defined.
Uh-huh.
Now, I got to ask you, that is so different than your usual political commentary. What led you up to writing that kind of article?
No, I switch around. I try to keep people from getting too bored. I don't try to be a one-trick pony.
Well, you certainly had my attention with that article. It was absolutely excellent, and I keep a link.
I sent a poem out the other day, a Cindy Sheehan poem that got pretty good play around the world. And even the other day, I tried I like to try different ways of communicating. And I sent out a one-sentence essay. Did you get that?
Yes, I did. I did.
Thing holds up. That's a one-sentence essay. What I would like people to be whispering that to each other all over the world. It goes like this, in case you've forgotten it. It goes, terrorists destroyed the World Trade Center. It would be the only time that George W.
John, I'm losing you.
Aha. Uh-huh. How's this, better?
Yeah, that's better. Right. Repeat that again, John.
If Arab terrorists, it would be the only time in his term.
Are you there, John? You know, I think we're losing the phone contact.
Oh, really?
Yeah, every time you try to say that sentence, and this isn't the first time this has happened on this show. I used to believe in coincidence, John. I no longer believe in it. We get under attack rather regularly, and I don't doubt that the powers that be fool with the phone lines. I'm not even sure exactly how they're doing it, but even tonight, as we've been talking, Don has been sending me notes, and again, we get weird fluctuation noises, and that happens both times that you tried to repeat that line. We got the same white noise coming in.
Want me to try it one more time? I'm in a different place here.
Yeah, let's try it.
If Arab terrorists destroyed the World Trade Center, it would be the only time during his terms as president that George W. Bush actually told the truth.
You know what? It got through that time. They must have got tired of pushing the button.
That's my one-sentence essay.
It's a good one. Do you think that the bombing in Oklahoma City, do you think that that was orchestrated?
Oh, of course. Of course it was. I mean, there's proof positive on that you can't blow a giant building out from the inside by exploding a truck in front of it. I mean,
yeah,
a fifth grader knows that.
I wrote a paper, a newsletter on gullibility for blogging service, and I was trying to get people to understand that we're all gullible. As far as the American public is concerned, I think we've reached the darn near the 100% level. It's the most absolute absurd to think that you could put a truck like that on the outside of a building and have that kind of damage.
No way.
We are running out of time. We've got about 10 minutes left, and I want to get to the fish parade. Wonderful article. I want to ask you something. Folks, the fish parade kind of speculates on the final outcome of humanity. John, is this what's going to happen to us? Will humans simply become humans floating in human waste? Do you think we've passed the point of no return in poisoning the environment?
Well, we've certainly seen examples of that graphic description here recently, of humans floating in waste. But I'm not optimistic because I don't see enough people asking the right questions.
Well, what kind of questions should we be asking, John?
How important is it to tell the truth?
Truth is a slippery thing. Yeah, and truth, kind of like beauty, kind of depends on the eye of the beholder.
Well, not when you're inventing reasons to go to war, blackmailing newspapers into suppressing all dissent about it. And,
oh, but they would also, all they would do, John, is say it's all in the national interest, so therefore telling a lie in this case is okay. I mean, they'll find a way to justify it.
There are things we've accepted in the past that have led us to our present place. And if we continue to accept them, it's just going to get worse. And that's what's going to happen. We're going to continue to accept them, and it's just going to get worse.
You point out a rather amazing piece of research. I have never seen it before, from Masaru Emoto. And, you know, John, I was so taken with those pictures of those water molecules.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
That I started posting it all over the net. Why don't you give the audience a little quick rundown on what I'm talking about with water molecules?
Mr. Emoto, water responds to emotion. He takes pictures of water molecules that are subjected to intense Mozart music, and they're perfectly symmetrical. And then he takes photographs of water molecules that have been subjected to various forms of poison, including heavy metal music, and shows how deformed these water crystals are. And it's just a really magical concept that if you understand it, it proves to you that water is alive and responds to human emotion. It's a fascinating subject.
Oh, absolutely. The pictures were phenomenal. As he subjected water to different types of stimuli, the actual structure of the molecule changed. And what got me, John, was that what you might think of as ugly came out looking ugly.
Right.
It was just an amazing piece of research.
Yeah, perfect mirror person. It has a reflective quality. There's all sorts of things that humans don't know. Humans don't know what consciousness is. Humans don't know where we came from or where we're going. And we pretend that we do know these things, but it's the things that we pretend to know and insist are true that we don't know and aren't true, those are the things that are hurting us.
Well, John, are we hopeless at this point? I mean,
I wish I saw more signs for optimism, but I don't.
So you're saying the genie that we created, the Habeck Garden, is so far out of the bottle that it seems impossible to fix?
I think it's going to get a lot worse, and only time will tell how much we'll put up with.
When we look at, let's jump to a subject everybody's concerned about right now. I'm sure you've got some information on it. We talk about the environment. We talk about Iraq. Let's talk about gasoline prices.
The what?
A lot of gasoline prices. A lot of people are saying this is just being contrived by the oil companies.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
I think it essentially is. I think peak oil is a hysterical hoax, and the only reason oil prices are going up is because they haven't built more refineries and they don't want to open up new fields, which are available, because it will diminish their profit curve. And they'd rather squeeze ordinary people than cut their profits by developing new sources and new technologies. And rather than being practical, they're being selfish, basically. And that's the way most people are.
That selfishness, though, doesn't seem to be, it doesn't seem to have a very good survival basis. In other words, it's kind of like a parasite killing off the host. If you kill off the host, then what do you do?
Well, I believe there's a realistic plan to reduce the Earth's population. I don't know if it's realistic, but it's an actual plan to reduce the Earth's population because they'd like it lower.
For what purpose?
To make the planet more functional and more profitable.
So it all comes back to money. I mean, how much money is enough, John? I mean, these people we're talking about already have all the money. How much more do they want?
No amount is enough.
It's never going to be satisfied, is what you're saying.
No, never.
In the aftermath of New Orleans, I want to quote you. Your metaphor is, quote, a Cajun Cabernet of pesticide-fouled Mississippi River water curdling in the backwater blender of the Gulf of Mexico dead zone.
Yeah.
You know what? That's a great metaphor. Now,
that drink needs a name.
Yeah, you know what, John? They just may start coming out with the name, you know, John's Vodka. What is this? What's going to happen to the rest of the country?
How about Bush's Bayou Blend?
Bush's Buddy Blend. It works for me. It's a heck of a statement. And I can't help but wonder, with all the pesticides, all the garbage floating around out there, in that
all the things in the biological weapons lab that washed away.
Yeah, won't this eventually wash up? You know, on different lakes, won't this eventually wind up across the United States itself?
I also live on the Gulf of Mexico, and I'm about as far away as from New Orleans as you can get and still be on the Gulf of Mexico, being in Southwest Florida. And about a week ago, when the waves broke during relatively inclement weather, mild rainy weather, when the surf would wash up on the shore, it would emit these incredibly noxious fumes that would make you cough and choke and sneeze. There was nobody on the beaches. The beaches were littered with dead fish. The whole Gulf of Mexico, after the disaster in New Orleans, has just turned into a toxic, smelly brew of everything that's wrong with human culture in the world today.
Well, I'm going to quote John one more time. Quote, close your eyes and you can envision the perfect portrait of human civilization. John, it sounds like a Mad Max scenario.
Is
that what's going to happen?
Yeah, that's happening.
And there's no way out.
We're going to go through it. Some of us are going to go through it. Some of us are going to be left floating in the brew.
You sound a little bit hopeful. I mean, you do sound like,
there's nothing we can do that will really harm the planet. Before we do that, the planet will eject us, and there seems to be some evidence of that, too.
Yeah, the planet seems to be reacting in a variety of ways, although some people say that even some of the major storms we've had lately were well planned. I don't know, John. It's hard to know what to believe anymore.
No, I don't do the weather control thing. That's beyond where I can go.
Let's get back to your concept of religion. You have a lot to say about religion.
Yeah, I do.
One of which is, quote, religion is a disease that is used to exploit people and commit crimes.
That's right.
Okay, go for it, John. There's a lot of people out there who are listening who do have a religion. So give us, in the 2 minutes we have left, why? What brings you to that conclusion about religion?
Well, just all of human history. All of human history. Think of the crimes that have been committed in the name of religion. And even worse than that, think about the maniacs like George W. Bush who stand up and say, God told me to drop nuclear bombs on Afghanistan. I mean, what kind of foolishness have we devolved into when all our mental faculties and reasoned judgments have to be suspended when some fool gets up in front of the world and says they bombed us because they hate our freedoms? That's second grade stuff, you know?
Yeah, it's not only second grade stuff, but we're, you know, I hate to say it, an awful lot of the mentality across the planet is a second-grade mentality, even when it concerns spirituality. You make I want to end this on a very positive note. There's something you said that really, really caught my awareness. Quote, aren't kindness and compassionate the ultimate currency? When the time comes to die, you will think they are. Count on it. John, there's a lot packed into that. I agree. Aren't kindness and compassion the ultimate currency? You seem to be suggesting that you yourself do believe in a judgment of sorts in terms of life after death. Do you?
What? I believe in
Well, you said when the time comes to die, you will think they are. Count on it. It seems to be suggesting you, the author of that statement, does believe in life after death.
No, I wouldn't make that joke. I believe it's an irrelevant question, but it becomes it becomes, for everyone at some point, it becomes the only question in their lives.
So you're not saying then that there's a judgment of sort. You're simply saying that this is the only currency you ever had, and at the time of death, then you better do something now or you won't have much.
We don't know. We know. But in case there is something, why don't you get, when you get to that point, you walk through it with pride that you've done the best that you can. You rely on If you rely on some sort of reward that is promised to you on the basis of magic formulas, I just think you're going to be solely disappointed. You're not going to be proud of yourself for that.
I agree. I agree 100%, John. John, it's the end of the hour. It's been absolutely fascinating. I wish we had more time. We don't. Can we get you back again?
Sure.
Okay, John, I'm going to sign off. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Okay, now, good luck to you.
Thank you, John. And that ends our show for tonight. Again, it was a fascinating journey into the realms of forbidden knowledge. Until next time, this is Nevin Campanella wishing all of you health, happiness, and a safe journey on your chosen path. Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.